Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hey, hi, my name is Francine. I'm an alcoholic. Can I pull this down a little bit? Will it mess you up? Even with high heels, I'm like short. So thank you. I want to first thank the committee and Ralph for this wonderful opportunity to be of service this evening. When did we speak together? About 6-7 years ago, before you started this, I think it was. Yeah, it's amazing. And but mostly I want to thank Robin. Where is Robin? She stepped, honestly. You know, every now and then you have the privilege of having a host or hostess who just you're in sync with, you know, who is so unbelievably amazing. And you guys tell her I said it. I mean, I've told her all day long, but she probably won't believe me. You'll tell her I said it. But she is fabulous. So I just want to say thank you. Thank you, Robin, wherever you are. So, welcome. If you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to say welcome to the first day of the rest of your life. And if you are new sitting in here right now, you're probably thinking to yourself, yeah, right. You know, what does she know? And I may not feel the same way you feel at this very moment, but trust me, I've been there. I've been there. And what I ask of you is that you stick around long enough for the fog to lift. Because if you do, amazing things will happen. In fact, more than amazing things will happen if you become willing a day at a time to not drink or use and just do a little bit of the things that we ask you to do. My sobriety date is July 26, 1979. If God willing a day at a time, if I don't die between July, I will be 40 years sober. I am 66 years old. And yesterday was my 21st wedding anniversary. Honestly, I don't know which of those numbers blows me away more. Honestly, probably the fact that I'm 66. I'm like so old. My second year of Medicare. I better grab it while I can. So anyway, I'm so glad you guys are here. And I'm grateful that I'm here tonight. Oh, I was in New York recently, and I'm in New York frequently. How many of you are from New York or have ever been there? If you've ever been to New York, especially, let's say, like 25 years ago, and if you've gone back in the last few years, especially if you've gone to Times Square, you've seen that there's been a change, a little change. Times Square used to be really, really seedy. Now it's just like a little bit. But I was back in New York, and I was staying at a hotel in the Times Square area on 54th and 7th, which is generally the area where I stay in when I'm there. And I was coming back from an event, and I was walking toward the corner to cross over the street to the hotel, and there was a woman standing on the corner. She was standing on the corner doing the pose. She was obviously selling everything she had of value. She was standing there on the corner with a pair of red Hoochie Mama pants that were so tight, it looked like somebody took a paintbrush and just painted fire engine red onto her skin. And she was wearing a top that was so sheer, you wondered why she even had a top on. And as I was walking toward the corner, toward her, there were a couple of women ahead of me who I would imagine were non-New Yorkers. It seemed like they had never been there before because they looked at her and they were kind of pointing and giggling and snickering and sneering. They gave her a look. And some of you know the kind of look I'm talking about. The kind of look we give to somebody when we think their station in life is beneath ours. I mean, I know what that look is about. You know, unfortunately, there have been times in my life when I have given someone that look. I like to tell you today, that's not the woman that I am, but I have been there. I have looked at people and thought, oh my God, you know, ugh, you know, I've been that person. But today I'm not. But I've also been on the other side. I've been the woman that people have given me that look and thought, oh God, what is she doing here? She doesn't belong here. So as I walked closer, as I got to the corner at the light, she was standing next to me, and I just turned to her and said hello. Not for any particular reason other than she was literally standing next to me. But I also said hello to her because I thought I knew her. No, I didn't know her. But in fact, I knew who she was. You see, 39 years ago, that was me, standing on that exact same street corner, selling everything I thought I had of value. I had become one more statistic, one more casualty in a life very, very poorly lived. You know, I've often been asked, and actually recently a newcomer, when she had heard my story, she said, "Oh my God, I can't believe you're saying that from the podium. How can you do that?" And you know, I said to her, number one, I tell the truth from the platform today because I can. But I also do it because I happen to believe that while not all of you have come to Alcoholics Anonymous with a shameful past, many of us have. See, I've seen shame drive people out of the rooms because they've kept those secrets to themselves. And I believe that every single time I, as a woman, have the courage to tell the truth about where I've come from, I give you, and you permission to do the same thing. Your history might not be the same as mine, but I believe that there was something that drove you in here that you vowed you'd die and go to your grave before you ever shared it. That's the kind of shame I'm talking about. So I share it for that reason, number one, because it's part of who I am, and I believe, again, every time I have the courage to tell the truth, I give someone else permission to do the same. But you know what? I also do it because that's not who I am anymore. You see, if I was still hooking, if I was still sleeping around with other people's husbands, if I was still doing the things I used to do, maybe I could be up here. I mean, I'm sure there are people who speak and live that double life, but I wouldn't be able to do it. So I can tell you that stuff today because that is absolutely not who I am. And it's not who I am, not because of any one thing I've done, but because of the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, I really do believe that Alcoholics Anonymous is the greatest gift that we have ever been given on this planet. The greatest gift. Because for people like me, that's the only thing that worked. I couldn't stop drinking, I couldn't stop using drugs, and I couldn't stop selling myself, compromising myself as a woman. I couldn't do it. And coming into Alcoholics Anonymous and then becoming willing, because that's the key. Lots of people come in, but then becoming willing to do what was suggested, well, I believe that's the story I have. So let me step back for a moment, because I didn't start out like that. I didn't start out on a street corner selling my body, and I can tell you, I can assure you, that's not the person my mother trained me to be. I grew up in a poor family, but I grew up with a hardworking mom who believed in morals and values. But somewhere along the line, I got lost. You know, in AA, in all of our literature, it actually talks about alcoholics being restless, irritable, and discontent. And that was my name. Restless, first name. Irritable, second name. Discontent, my last name. That was me. I was never, ever happy where I was. I always wanted to be somewhere else, doing something else with somebody else. Never happy with where I was. And you know, I know my mother really worked hard to take care of two little girls by herself. But I was always the one that created the problem because I never, ever was satisfied, even as a little kid. I was born in Atlanta, Georgia, 66 years ago. And you know, I don't remember a lot about those early days. But what I do remember is, again, as a kid, I was just always unhappy. You know, I never fit in. I never, ever fit in. And early in life, I discovered that there were ways to get out of myself long before I ever picked up a drink or a drug. I hated myself as I hated being black. I hated being a girl. I hated being a southerner. I hated being poor. I remember my family moved from New York, from Atlanta, Georgia to New York when I was 6 years old. And I moved and I had a really strong southern accent, if you can possibly imagine that. I mean, y'all was part of my vocabulary all the time. Sweet tea. I mean, I was a southerner. And, you know, when I moved to New York, the kids made fun of me. I mean, it was wicked. You know, I often wonder, and this is not to condone their behavior, but I often wonder when kids commit crimes in school, if it's not because they have been battered and beat up and bullied. Really. Because that's what happened to me. I mean, I didn't, instead of turning my anger outward, I turned mine inward. But as a Southerner, it was so painful when I moved to New York because, boy, they made fun of me. I hated being poor. You know, I often hear people from the platform talk about how they grew up poor, but they really didn't know it. Well, I can tell you that was not my experience. I grew up poor, and I absolutely knew it. I had an intimate relationship with powdered eggs and powdered milk, and I didn't like it one bit. It was not something I was proud of, and everything I did, actually, as an adult, until I got sober, was about not being poor, was not growing up like my mother. You know, everything. Oh, let me forewarn you, if you have a problem with middle-aged women who cannot control their emotions, you might want to leave, because I absolutely make no apologies for leaking. I mean, it comes out when it does. So I just want to warn you, you can leave if that's a problem. So I hated being poor. I hated being a girl. You know, I grew up in I was born and raised in the 50s and the 60s when being a girl, you know, it was a painful experience. You know, girls were treated differently. Oh, thank you. Girls were treated differently. They still are, but they were really treated differently back in the day. And, you know, I remember I developed quickly or young at an early age. I'm small now. This is about the size I was at 11 or 12. And while it's small for an adult woman, when I'm a kid, that's pretty traumatic. And I used to wear big shirts to cover my breasts because it was so embarrassing. I hated being a girl. I hated it. But mostly I hated being black. I grew up in the South during the time of lynchings. And I remember as a kid, I used to use razor blades to take off my skin, and I'd use bleaching cream to try to take off my color because I couldn't stomach living in this body. I couldn't stomach being who I am. You know, I remember a few weeks back, I was driving into San Francisco. I live in Marin and in Palm Desert, and Marin County is Sausalito, Mill Valley, right north of San Francisco. I was driving into the city, and there was this hitchhiker standing there with a sign that said, "Anywhere but here." And I knew exactly what he was talking about. Maybe he was talking about just getting out of Marin County, but you know what? I knew what that meant. Anywhere but here. All my life, I just wanted to be anywhere but in this skin, in this body. I remember when I was younger, I used to pray to a God I didn't believe in to allow me to just unzip my skin and step out because I just couldn't stand being here. And so I think if there was anybody paying attention to me when I was a little kid, anybody who was sensitive to children, sensitive to the pain of children, they knew that eventually I was going to find a way out. They knew that there's no way I could live in my little body, in this body, in this experience, and survive. And so way before I picked up drugs and alcohol, I discovered books and movies. My mom was a librarian, and oh my God, I loved books. How lucky I am I grew up with them, honestly. I believe it was one of the best things that could have happened to me, although it didn't stop me from drinking and using. But my mother, whenever they were doing inventory at the library, my mom would bring all these extra books home. And in our house, honestly, it looked like a library. In every room, on every wall, there were reams and reams and reams of books. It was so fabulous. And sometimes I'd take a book off the shelf, and I'd go sit in a corner all by myself. And I think my mother probably thought I was trying to become a smart kid. But you know what was happening? When I opened up those binders, between those binders was magic. Magic. I mean, all of a sudden, I don't know why I'm crying so much now. There's no reason. I was like Cinderella going to the ball. It was so fabulous. I mean, I'd sit there and just read and read, and I became the characters in the books, and it was wonderful. And I loved old movies, although I must tell you, when I was growing up, they were not old. They're only old today. I loved women like Betty Davis and Joan Crawford and Barbara Stanwyck and Susan Hayward. They were my idols. They were women who had a cigarette in one hand and a glass in the other, and they didn't take a whole lot of garbage off anybody. And I love that because I had this huge hole in my gut that just needed to be filled with something. Now, I just scan the room, and when I mention those four names, I see a couple of people like, who is she talking about? So I can tell the youngins in here, that's for sure. Who is Betty Davis? Who is Joan Crawford? So they were my idols, and I learned so much. I learned how to smoke cigarettes by watching Betty Davis in All About Eve. If some of you remember that movie, she's having this big party, and she's walking up the staircase with that long, sexy cigarette holder, talking about it's going to be a bumpy ride. Had she only known how bumpy the ride was to become. It was like I'd stand in the mirror, and I'd puff and choke like a good addict. And I'd keep doing it until I stopped choking. And I remember one day I was at home and my mother, you know what? Alcoholics, we think we're hiding things from people, honestly, but we aren't. People know about us long before we admit it. And I remember I'd be smoking. I'd come home from school. I'd be in my room with the window open, blowing smoke out of the window, thinking my mother couldn't smell it. Hello. With a little wind from New York, it was waffling throughout the house. And she'd come in and she caught me every single time. But you know what? I just kept doing it because that's what good little addicts do. And so I learned how to smoke cigarettes, and I learned how to hold my glass with my pinky stuck out. And I still have a tendency to do it. I learned that by watching Susan Hayward in Backstreet. And there are a few other things I learned by watching that girl. Anybody remember that movie? In Backstreet, essentially, she's having a relationship with somebody who's not her husband, a husband of someone else. And, you know, I'm not proud of the history of where I've come from, but neither am I ashamed anymore because that's not who I am. And all the years that I have done the real work in AA, not just giving it lip service, because, you know, the real indicator of my work is how I live today. Not what I say, because talk's cheap. A lot of us know how to talk. I don't quote from books. A lot of us know how to talk. But it's how do I behave? How do I show up in the world? How do I show up with you? How do I show up with people that are not in AA meetings? How do I show up with my family? That's the real indicator of the kind of program that I've been taught to have. So I learned those things from watching those women. And you know, for a long time, that's all I had. Is they were the only ones I had as role models until I came to you. And then I started having role models in Alcoholics Anonymous, but it would be many, many years before that was to happen. My drinking and my using took me to places that, quite honestly, no woman should ever have to go. And being a hooker, I have to tell you, was a low bottom, but it wasn't the lowest. For me as a woman, the lowest thing that ever happened to me was when I allowed men to put their hands on me. I became a target. You put a very vulnerable person, a very vulnerable woman, you add alcohol to the mix, and then anything happens. And I was a punching bag for many, many, many years. To me, that is the lowest thing that happened to me as a woman in my life, that I hated myself so much that I allowed men in my life to beat up on me and then try to convince me that it was my fault that they beat the crap out of me. That doesn't happen anymore. I will assure you, no man has put their hands on me since I've been sober, because I care enough about me. And I say that now in meetings because I know that there are women sitting in here right now, and maybe men too, who are experiencing those moments of quiet desperation, thinking they are the only one that's ever gone through that. Well, you're not. There are many of us that have, and if somebody wants to grab me afterward, I am happy to talk. But the thing is, I had to get sober to be willing to not let that happen to me. I do not allow anybody to abuse me today. And the abuse was not just physical. It was emotional. I allowed people to mentally screw with my mind because my mind was so malleable, because I let them do it. And today I know that I did let them do it, whatever the reasoning was, and today I choose not to. But I had to get sober to stop being a punching bag. I had to get sober to stop selling my body. I had to get sober to stop settling for seconds in my life, because before then, I never thought I deserved it. So in 1978, I was first introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was living in New York, and I wasn't ready to get sober. I'll just say that I wasn't ready. A therapist told me I needed to go to an AA meeting, and only because she told. Now this is how sick my mind was. This therapist I was seeing said to me I had an allergy to alcohol. I swear to God, this is true. I thought it was a real allergy. I had gone and gotten this allergy test, where anybody ever have them, they stick all these little needles in you, and there was nothing that said I was allergic to alcohol. So I couldn't understand what she was saying. And she then had to keep pushing me and pushing me, and she eventually pushed me into my first AA meeting in New York. It was the 71st Street Workshop. And it's no longer there. This was on 71st Street and 7th Avenue. And I remember, 2nd Avenue, I'm sorry. And I remember going into that meeting, just knowing that this was not the place for me. It was everything I imagined an alcoholic to look like, an old man with an overcoat, with a bottle hanging out of the back of his pocket, and veins popping out of his face. Now, I don't know if that's what those guys look like, but that's what I thought they looked like. And so I thought, you know, this is so not for me. And I would go to meetings, and I would drink in between. Now, that may work for some people, but it really didn't work for me. And I continued to drink until it was, well, before then, I did what I discovered was a geographic. It was in the summer of 1978. I was still living in New York, and I thought New York was going to legalize gambling because that's what they were talking about. And so I was prepared to, you know, change my profession because, well, I needed to. Anyway, I moved out to Vegas thinking that when New York decided not to legalize gambling, I decided to move out to Vegas because I thought if I physically moved myself from here and moved here, my problem would go away. But surprise, if there is anybody in here thinking, if you move from A to B, the problem will disappear. In fact, the problem followed me because I am the problem. So I moved out to Vegas in 1978 at the end. And in June of 1979, I got hit by a car in a blackout. And today, I don't even remember everything that happened. The last thing I remember was I was sitting in a discotheque, and we did used to have those, discotheque in Las Vegas, Nevada. And the next thing I remember was I came to with my entire body in traction, and my left leg was in a cast all the way up my thigh. And I still walk, I walk with a limp. My left leg is an inch shorter than my right leg. I have a 10-inch scar that I don't hide. And I've had people over the years ask me if I'd be willing to consider cosmetic surgery because the scar is really ugly. Again, it's 10 inches, lots of hole marks. And I can tell you for myself, just for today, I choose not to cover up the scar because every single time I look at my leg, I'm reminded of the very high price I had to pay to stand before you tonight. I'm reminded of every drink I ever drank, of every drug I ever put in my body, and of every inappropriate act as a woman I have ever performed. And so when I look at that leg, it's a great reminder. But I'd also like to tell you that, and for the real alcoholics in here, no mere car accident is going to stop you when you are on a mission. I came out of the hospital, and on the way home, in the route home, I had the person who was picking me up stop at the liquor store, and I continued to drink for another month and a half, until the end of July of 1979. And I pray to God that was my last drunk. You know, nothing's promised to any of us. And I've been sober long enough to have seen many, many, many people go out with many years of sobriety. But I pray to God that was my last first drink. I was reintroduced seriously to Las Vegas AA in 1979. And honestly, you know, people have said to me, how could you get sober in Vegas? And I'm a believer that when your number is up, wherever you are lucky enough to be, God bless you. And God knew I had to go to such an extreme place to get the kind of AA I needed in order to stay sober. I came in with a really bad attitude. I mean, a really bad attitude. I came in on crutches, and I used to sit in the back of the room in what I call the inventory section. And there were other people back there like me who I used to sit. I took up three seats, one for my bottom. We got that. One for my broken leg. It had to be up. I'd have a seat for my crutches because that's who, I mean, my attitude was so bad. I didn't want too many people around me. And I'd sit in the back of the room, and I'd have my arms crossed, and I dare you to make my day. I dare you to say something that was going to make me stay here. I hated everybody. I didn't like men, and I didn't like women, and that doesn't really leave a whole lot of people in between. I mean, I just couldn't stand anybody. And I'd sit and I'd take inventory, especially of the women. You know, God help me, you know, thank God for the women in Alcoholics Anonymous, because they had my number early on. I couldn't stand women, and especially the women who were not like me. I didn't like the women who were sober too long, they were looking too good, their lives had changed. I really didn't want to hear what they had to say. I didn't mind the girls like me who were sleeping with other people's husbands, who were acting out. They couldn't judge me because they were just like me, but I didn't like the Miss AA types. And boy, that's come around full circle. I've had many girls say that about me, but I couldn't stand them. And you know, the irony is when I got the look. The two sponsees are sitting up here. It's like, oh, brother. At 30 days sober, everybody had my number. And they introduced me to perhaps the single most important person in my life. Her name was Louise, and I hated her with a passion. I hated this woman so, I actually hated a lot of people. Obviously, you hear the word come out. I didn't like myself, so how could I like someone else? But Louise, I really couldn't stand. And you know, it's interesting. If there's some real old timers here, you remember Helen Louise? So Helen Louise was, my sponsor was sponsored by Helen Louise's father, Louise. And oh God. So when I'm in LA, I feel like I'm looking at my family here. Really, it's kind of cool. My aunts and my uncles and my sisters. So I met Louise, and you know why I hated her so much, though? The irony is that she was the first person who ever had the courage to tell me the truth. That's why I didn't like her. You know, I'm amazed at how many, I've had so many sponsees fire me because they didn't like one thing I said. They fired me like that because you're just judging me. You're too hard. Well, it's a good thing they didn't get sober when I did because, you know, really, I mean, Louise did not care that I didn't like her. And it's a good thing because it gave her permission to be herself and she called it like it was. I want to share with you three things in particular that she taught me, and I happen to believe that the woman I am today is significantly a result of the sponsorship I got from this woman. So the first thing is I had a nasty little habit of sleeping with other people's husbands. And, you know, I don't know why, I just couldn't keep my paws to myself. And I remember one day Louise said to me, you know, she was the first person who ever said self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. And actually, I want to read this. I didn't have my book, so I'm pulling it up off of my Kindle. I remember I'd go to meetings and I would say, but Louise, these people are talking about, they say it's only about not drinking. And she said, it is not just about not drinking. She said, here is what Bill W. had to say. So I'm going to read this. It's from the very first page of As Bill Sees It, which is conference-approved literature. It has often been said of AA that we are interested only in alcoholism. That is not true. We have to get over drinking in order to stay alive. But anyone who knows the alcoholic personality by firsthand contact knows that no true alkie ever stops drinking permanently without undergoing a profound personality change. Not a little personality change, not one if you feel like it, but Louise said to me, if you want what we have, then you need to do what we do. And so these three things in particular, she taught me in terms of change behavior. And believe me, I went kicking and screaming. None of these things I have changed easily or willingly. The first thing was not sleeping with other people's husbands. So I remember saying to her one day, but Louise, wait a second, you don't understand. What if I'm walking down the street and this guy is holding on to his honey and he's giving me the eye? What am I supposed to do? And I thought it was the stupidest thing she said to me. She simply said, you should turn your head. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, why should I have to take the high road? That is not fair. And I mean, I couldn't understand, because he can't keep his pants zipped, I have to be better. Well, I didn't like it, but you know what? I can tell you today, there is not one single woman in this room or any room who would ever have to worry about me putting the make on her man or her woman or anybody, her boyfriend. There's not one single woman. Now, that might not mean a lot to most of you, but to me, self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. And I have discovered that the reason I not only have stayed sober, but having the kind of sobriety that I have, is because I had a sponsor who believed that action was the key. She told me there was an entire chapter in the big book called Into Action, and most of our steps are in there. She said, you know, you can do whatever you want, but if you keep doing what you've been doing, you will keep getting what you've been getting. And it was like, hello. It's like, you know, she said, if you put in a little bit, you're going to get back a little bit. If you put in nothing into your recovery, then you'll find yourself drunk. And if you put in a lot, you're going to get much more than you ever, ever could imagine. So today I do not sleep with anybody else's husbands. I don't even give them the eye. The truth is, I have a husband, and I don't know how people can deal with more than one. Really, it's like, wow, one is enough. So you can trust me in the room with your man. The second thing she taught me in terms of behavior change, and that's what it's all about for me, changing my behavior. I had to learn how to dress differently. So that woman on the corner, she actually didn't have anything over on me. I used to go into AA meetings with hot pants, that even when they were not in style, hot pants the size of a sash, about 6 inches. Now, I was a lot thinner, but even still, my cheeks were hanging out all over the place. And I would wear these little tops. Really, it was like a strip. Strip here, strip here. And that was it. And I still wear heels, but I used to wear heels with the big taps. Some of the girls remember the big taps. And I would come into meetings late, always late. I'd always walk across the front of the room, and I'd walk with my taps and my little hot pants. And, I mean, why not? I mean, I thought it was like, why not? And Louise thought that was not acceptable. She thought that, again, self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. And she said, you teach people how to treat you. You know, if you act like a whore, you will be treated like a whore. If you dress like a hooker, you will be treated like a hooker. And if every other word out of your mouth is a four-letter word, then that's what you're going to get back. And so, you know, I learned how to dress differently. I still wear bathing suits, not bikinis. Because that's about what I was wearing in those meetings. But I'm even mindful of that. You know, I dress appropriately for the occasion today. But the last thing she taught me, and again, this is not where anybody has to make their changes, but for me, it was important. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous with a filthy mouth. Every other word out of my mouth was a four-letter word. And I cursed because I could. Because I could, and because everybody else was doing it. And I remember one day, this is way before cell phones or anything, it was when answering machines just came into the picture. Oh, God. I left a message for her, and she saved it, and then she had the audacity to play it back. And I have to tell you, even I was appalled. I couldn't believe there were so many F words, SH words, and MF. MF and MS. I couldn't even believe it. I was even shocked, really. After that, we did some work, and she helped me go from 20 curse words to a sentence down to 10 curse words to a sentence. And then we reduced it to like 5 curse words to a sentence. And then it was like 3 curse words. And then it was like every other sentence had a curse word until, quite honestly, one day I was not cursing. And it's an interesting thing. She had said to me, you know, every time you curse, you take the focus off of your message and you put it on you. She said, it's really lazy language. You put it on you, not the message. Well, the truth is, I had a messy message, so I didn't really care if you heard me or not. But her point was well taken. And it took me many, many years, but today I choose not to curse. And you know, people make fun of me today. I don't really care. I'm sober long enough. I don't really care. But they call me Pollyanna. They call me all kinds of whatever because I choose not to curse. But you know what? I've discovered that there were some other words in my vocabulary that I could pull out. And if I didn't know a word, I could learn them. And that took me to the next piece of my life. You know, when Louise had me learning some new words, I had to go to the dictionary. And there were so many words in the big book I didn't even understand. Whoever heard of the word rapacious? Or vicissitude? I mean, these are words I didn't even know what the word humble meant. I had to look it up. And so as I started looking up words in the book and the dictionary, I started to take an interest in words. And I started to take an interest in learning. And so there was a woman, there were two women, one woman in Vegas, her name is Lynn. She had gone back to school for hotel administration, and she was going to UNLV. And she allowed me to come in with her and audit the class. And I started sitting in the class, and wow, I started to actually have a desire for learning for the first time. I mean, I'm a high school dropout. I'm an ex-hooker with a criminal record. So education was not at the top of my list. And plus, not one of those men that were paying me ever asked me where I went to school. They didn't care. They didn't ask me if I had a degree. But I started to take an interest, and it was like, oh my God, I started to discover I had a brain. That was the thing. I wasn't just this body. And then I had heard June G speak. She'd come to Vegas. I think she was 7 years sober when I first met her. She had 13 years of sobriety, and she'd gone back to school. And I thought, oh, my God, wow. The brain started working. And so I decided I was going to go back to school. I decided I was going to go back to school to pursue this career that people just thought, you know what, Francine, I think you have the wrong thing in mind. You should probably find something easier to go after. They said, maybe, you know, medical assistant, maybe a paralegal, maybe a secretary. I mean, something. And those are all honorable professions, but it's not what I wanted to do. It's not what I wanted to do. And my sponsor, Louise, she was the only person that really believed in me at the time. At least she acted as if she did. She probably really didn't, but she acted as if. And she said, you know, you can do anything you want in sobriety if you are willing to do the work. And I thought, no, but you don't understand. You know, not me. I can't. I mean, I have a criminal record. There's no way I'm going to be able to do anything. She said, if you're willing to do the work, anything is possible. And I stand before you because I know that there are people in this room, maybe not everyone, maybe not most of you. There are a couple of you in here. Maybe you failed a test and you've given up. Maybe you had a dream and you just thought, no, I can never go there. I tell you, anything's possible. If you don't drink or use drugs and you become willing to do the work, anything is possible. Anything. So I decided to go back to school in Vegas. I had to get my GED. And then I moved back to New York to put myself through college. And in 1986, I graduated from college and I moved to Washington, D.C. to complete my education. And in 1989, I graduated from one of the top law schools in this country. And I can tell you, for a kid who used to pay lawyers a fortune to keep her out of jail, the fact that I stand before you admitted to any bar, not a drinking bar, of course, any bar, it's unbelievable. I just want to tell you a story about the law, though. When I first started practicing law, I had to represent a criminal. I understood that one. And in New York, in criminal court, the judge says, will the defendant please stand up? And I stood up. I was the lawyer. I stood up. Now, fortunately for me, oftentimes lawyers will stand up too. But it was just an automatic reflex. Because, in fact, that's the same court that I had, you know, a record with. It's an amazing thing what happens. And I did not drink over that. I like to tell you also that I'm a practicing lawyer today. It's been 28 years, but I failed the bar many, many, many times before I passed. And I like to share that because sometimes with newcomers, and even not so newcomers, you know, they'll hear us talk about where we are today and they'll think it's so easy. Well, no, it's not, maybe for some people. But for me, it was very, very hard. But because of the kind of sponsorship I had, where you just don't give up, you just keep showing up, just like my sobriety, I didn't give up and I got to overcome it. But I failed the New York bar twice. I obviously do not know how to take tests because it's not the first, second, or third. But New York, I failed twice. And me and John F. Kennedy Jr. ended up, some of you know who he is? Yeah, okay. Again, I see some of the eyes. Who's John F. Kennedy Jr.? We both passed at the same time. And it's an interesting thing. John F. Kennedy's, his face was splattered all over the New York Times and the Daily Post. Mine was just splattered in AA meetings because that's when I was speaking literally every single weekend in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I always told the truth. And I'd sit up here and it would be painful to tell you that I failed yet again. But I did it because, again, I've learned how to be honest. I've learned how to be authentic. It doesn't always feel good. It rarely looks good. But I'm where I am today because of the willingness I have to tell you the truth. So then when I moved out here to California, I moved to LA. And, you know, one would think after failing two times, I would know how to take tests. I tell you, I stopped counting how many times I failed the California bar at six. I have no idea how many times I actually failed. I stopped counting at six. I am admitted to the California bar now since 2007. And then I'm admitted to the D.C. bar. Two of the most difficult bars in the country because I was not willing to give up. And, you know, when I was first deciding to go back to school, I had most people telling me, again, I couldn't do it. And what I discovered is I was going to the wrong people. You know, I had a tendency to go, and this is the way I like to put it, I went to hardware stores looking for oranges. I was going to places, to people who were living in fear, expecting them to encourage me out of my fear. How could they? They were the ones that kept telling me, honey, stay small. You don't need to, you know, stay small. I love that Marianne Williamson phrase that came from her book, Return to Love, how she talks about, you know, I don't need to shrink so that other people can feel comfortable around me. And Louise taught me that same thing in other words. I learned it here in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I was going to people who were afraid to leave a job they hated. They were afraid to get out of a relationship that was deadly. They were doing things they hated. So how could I expect them to say, go, girl, you can do it. But again, thanks to Louise, she said you can do anything you want if you're willing to do the work. I also like to tell you that during the time I was failing the bar, God had some other plans for me. And it's an interesting thing how that happens. Sometimes when you're not paying attention or when you're looking in one direction, God has a temporary detour. And during that time when I just, you know, I had to put the bar down, the California bar, because it was really, it had eaten a big part of me up. I mean, I was, every day was about preparing for the bar, taking the bar, failing the bar. You know, it was this horrible cycle. And so I had to put it on the back burner for quite a number of years. And during that time, I wrote a couple of books. And you know, God's way of helping me look at myself, look at the things that I have needed to look at in my life, have come through many different sources. It's come through people. It's come through writing, because it's just like a journaling. You know, it's come through me getting the stuff out of me and putting it on paper. And that's what I've been allowed to do on many, many levels. You know, when I was new in sobriety and I was invited to make a list of all the things I wanted out of sobriety, like so many people have said, I would have shortchanged myself. You know, all I wanted back were, I wanted diamond rings and kitty cats and stereos and, you know, fur coats. The things I lost, those are the things I wanted. I never, ever, ever, ever asked for anything substantive because When I was newly sober, I couldn't think like that. But, you know, the gifts of my sobriety have all been intangibles. They've all been intangibles. One of the greatest gifts has been the gift of a power greater than myself that I choose to call God. I was agnostic when I got sober. And that means, for people that are not really clear, I believed, I knew there was a God. I was, you know, baptism was thrust upon me as Southern Baptist as a kid. So I knew there was a God, but I knew that God wasn't for me. How could that possibly be me living the life I was living? How could there be a God? So I ostracized God for many, many years. But I do believe that it was a God I didn't believe in that got me into Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was ultimately Alcoholics Anonymous that took me to that God. And how grateful I am for that. I'm the person that the 11-step talks about today, that I would no more do without my faith than I would air, food, or sunshine. My God's different today than it was when I first started to believe. My God is not a he. I'm so sorry. It is not a he. For a long time, it was a she. And I would make sure everybody knew that. Everybody. Today, it's my creator. Today, that's what works for me. You know, it's my creator. Another gift on that list of intangibles that I have received is the gift of courage. I used to think that courage was an absence of fear. But today I know that courage is about being afraid and having the courage to walk through it. See, I was afraid when I got up here. I'm always scared, so I'm not going to lie to you. Every time I have to get up on a platform, every time I have to do anything that's different, or any time I have to put myself out there, I'm always afraid. But unlike some people, I will do it anyway. See, I walk through the fear, and it always takes me an hour to meditate before I speak, just to allow God to come in and say, okay, Francine, you remember the purpose here. Not everybody's going to like you. It's okay. You remember your purpose. But the fear is there, but I walk through it. Courage is one of the greatest gifts I've been given, a willingness to feel the fear and do it anyway. Another one of those intangible gifts on that amazing list that I've been given has been the gift of my mother. I know in a meeting with a lot of women, that's a taboo topic, and I get it, because when I got sober, I hated my mother with a passion. You know, people would tell me, oh, you look like Rose, and it was like, oh, God. It's like they took a dagger and just stabbed me with it. I hated her. So I didn't talk to my mother for my first 2 years of sobriety, but thank God for that sponsor. That sponsor who believed that if I'm really working the 12 steps and not talking about it, it's impossible for me to not have a relationship with my mother. I don't care what anybody says. I'm sorry. If I am really working the steps, there is a relationship with those family members that I hated. And my mom was at the very top of my amends list. I just got back from New York for Mother's Day. Today, my mother is one of my best friends. And we've had our challenges. Even in the years that I'm sober, and even in the years that we've cleaned it up. But, you know, today, if my mother would have dropped dead right at this moment, I would be sad. I would be so hurt. But there is no unfinished business in my relationship with my mom. There is no unfinished business. I was going to New York every single month for 4 years, up until last year. My mother is a double amputee. And last year, I got in my mother's way because I know better, and I do sometimes. My mom, her first leg was removed. I had gone to New York. My mother's sitting there eating cookies, and I read her the Riot Act. She reminded me. She asked me to leave her house. She said, "You are not my mother. I am your mother." And do you know, that was a wake-up call for me. That was a wake-up call. She was so right. And so it was in that moment that I had to give her her space and let her do whatever she wants. So I stopped going every month, but now I go about 4 or 5 times a year. But my mom and I are very close. I talk to her all the time, and that's because of what you've given me. That's what Louise taught me, that my mother, I am my mother. And if I hated her, I was hating me. Another gift on that list of intangibles has been the gift of love, genuine love. You know, we talk about love in AA, and, you know, some people really mean it, some people don't, whatever. But what you've taught me, again, is a real indicator of how I work the steps is how my feet move. So I have learned how to have an open heart, and I have learned the hard way. Because I've even discovered in Alcoholics Anonymous there's prejudice. I've been to meetings where I haven't been welcome. I felt it. and places where, you know, were really small places that I knew it was there. But today, if you look at my friends and the people in my life looks like I say it looks. Today, my life is as diverse as I say it is. That is because of Alcoholics Anonymous. The women I sponsor are of different races. My girlfriends are of different races. My husband is a different race. My husband is Jewish, and he's from the Bronx. And I have to tell you, that's not even the real diversity issue in our family. The real diversity issue is my husband is a therapist, a lawyer and a therapist. Go figure. In the same space. But in my family, in my life, it's not just talking, it's how do I live? And so for me today, if I'm really talking about loving other people, how does it show up? Are all my friends looking like me? So you've given me a lot in the years I'm sober. You've given me so much. And you know, I look at myself today and honestly, I want to pinch me. I can't believe that I am the woman that I am. I can't believe that you have made me the woman that you've made me. And so I want to say thank you to you. And in closing, I want to read something else from conference-approved literature, just in case we've got a few purists in the room. I know there are some of you because I can smell it. I know. Those Louise types. I know she got over here in L.A. I know. I know who you guys are. So this is from page 4 of Asbel Season, and I usually carry my book. I hate having a phone on in an AA meeting, which I never, ever, ever do. My sponsees know if I catch their phones on, no, that's a fine. Just like if they curse, that's a fine. But I didn't have my book, and I wanted to read this from Conference Approved Literature because it's so powerful. I like to end my talks with this on page 4, and it's titled, Can We Choose? We must never be blinded by the futile philosophy that we are just the hapless victims of our inheritance, of our life experience, and of our surroundings, that these are the sole forces that make our decisions for us. This is not the road to freedom. We have to believe that we can really, really choose. You know, when I got sober, I was a victim on every level. I was a victim of my race. I was a victim of my gender. I was a victim in my mind. And when you think you're a victim, you act like a victim. One of the greatest gifts you've given me is the fact that I am no longer a victim. I don't act like one. I don't let you treat me like one. Today, I am no longer a victim of my history. I no longer allow my past to strangle me. It's not because of anything I've done alone. Believe me, I've had to do something. I know a lot of people say I didn't do anything. I've done a lot. I've had to do the work. Otherwise, I wouldn't have the experience I have today. But I didn't do it alone. I didn't do it. I did it with you, and I did it with God. And for that, I'm so grateful. Thank you, guys, for my sobriety.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.